Welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two interviews up tonight. First, in about 10 minutes or so, we'll hear from Dr. Bryant Welch, a psychoanalyst who has put the body politic of the United States of America on the couch in his book, State of Confusion, Political Manipulation and the Assault on the American Mind, published by Thomas Dunn Books, the imprint of St. Martin's Books. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Glenn Horowitz, who is the media director at Greenpeace, and he will be talking about how we should not use the financial crisis as an excuse to stop thinking about climate change and other environmental issues. Quite the contrary, that dealing with those issues could be a way out of financial and economic crisis in about almost half an hour. Before all that, a few words on the economic news. We're starting to see some more real-world effects of the credit crisis, with an emphasis on starting. Thursday morning, the Bureau of Economic Analysis reported that GDP contracted by 0.3% in the third quarter of this year at an annualized rate adjusted for inflation, as all the numbers I'm about to unleash are. This is a mild contraction, but some of the components beneath that headline number were anything but mild. Personal consumption was down by over 3%, also at an annualized rate. That was the first such decline since 1980, and it was a pretty steep decline, and I'm guessing that it won't be the last, since I think the U.S. is in the middle of a structural shift towards less spending, less borrowing, and more saving if there's enough income growth to support that saving. Residential investment, the building of new housing and the renovation of existing housing stock, was down by almost 20%, a steep decline, though not quite as steep as some recent quarters. The major things keeping the headline number from being even more negative were exports and government spending, both up around 6% on the quarter. The export number is lower than the second quarter, and with the rest of the world's economy slowing down, export numbers are not likely to look very strong in the coming quarters, so we expect a little more weakening trend on that component. The government number was stronger in recent quarters, thanks in large part to military spending, which is a pretty debased use of public funds. More on debased uses of government funds in a bit. In somewhat more reassuring news, we also learned on Thursday morning that first-time claims for unemployment insurance were unchanged last week. The reassuring part of that news is they didn't rise, meaning that the job market isn't deteriorating at an accelerating pace. But it is deteriorating. Jobless claims remain high, not at record levels, but still high. This portends continuing job losses in the coming months. We'll get the employment report for October next Friday. Though I haven't crunched the numbers yet, my guess is that we'll see something like 250,000 jobs lost and another uptick in the unemployment rate. I'd say it's pretty close to certain that the jobless rate will move up towards 8% by the middle of next year, which would be a rise of nearly 2 percentage points. It's already up about 2 percentage points from its cycle low, so we're at best only halfway through this employment decline. As I've been saying, all the government's financial rescue operations will probably keep the worst at bay, not just our government's, but that of those around the world. Keeping the worst at bay means a rerun of the early 1930s, but it can't guarantee anything resembling prosperity. And as I've also been saying, we're likely to see several years of a pretty bad economy. I see no reason to change any of that prognosis. A bright sign is that we are seeing some unsticking of the credit markets. Those aren't too likely to return to robust health for some time, but at least they're showing signs of thawing out, as they must if we want to prevent that rerun of the 1930s. Back to those debased uses of public funds I was talking about a little while ago. It's looking like the financial sector is applying many of the billions it's getting from the government towards its own preferred ends and not aiding in an economic revival. A report by the excellent Mary Williams Walsh in the Thursday New York Times questions what the hell AIG is doing with $123 billion it's gotten from the Federal Reserve. It appears to have burned through most of that cash, and no one knows exactly how or why. AIG isn't telling. What kind of nonsense is this? A company auditor has gone AWOL and is in seclusion. The company, long known for its funny accounting, apparently hasn't shaken the habit, and so far as we know, the Fed isn't twisting its arms to make it change its ways. And it also looks like many of the banks that have gotten equity infusions from the Treasury are using the money to continue paying dividends to their stockholders rather than rebuilding their balance sheets or making loans. That, too, is an outrage. A proper government equity infusion would require the banks taking the cash to suspend dividend payments. And the equity should be of the voting kind, meaning the Fed should have a dominant voice in management. But Treasury Secretary Paulson has opted for non-voting shares because he doesn't want to step on management's toes. If toes ever deserve to be stepped on, nay, run over with a steamroller, it's those of Wall Street CEOs. Not only are those debased uses of public funds, the banks are negating any of the good effects of a public bailout. The IMF, which was off the scene for many years, is, like a vampire salivating at sunset, returning to the fray. It's already developed a program for Iceland, which is being put through an austerity wringer. Apparently being white and Nordic doesn't earn you an exemption after all. It's likely to lend some money to some countries that it deems virtuous on easy terms, among them Brazil, but not Argentina. And a host of countries that it doesn't deem virtuous will be getting the rough treatment in the coming weeks. More on all this as the news unfolds. Finally, let me repeat the conclusion of a talk I gave at the City University Grad Center at a panel organized by David Harvey on Wednesday night. There's a lot of talk about how this financial crisis marks the end of the neoliberal era, which it may be, and also portends the return of the state, which is a little more complicated. Neoliberalism, a word that's more popular in the outside world than in the U.S., took hold in the early 1980s. Its most prominent feature is an almost religious faith in the efficiency of unregulated markets. The ideal is, or was, to make the real world resemble the financial markets as much as possible, with continuous trading at constantly updated prices. To do that requires the commodification of everything, including water and air. Needless to say, much of that agenda was successfully accomplished. But the agenda wasn't just the result of a bad mood the body politic woke up back in 1979 or 1980. It was a response to some real problems: chronic inflation, and from the elite's point of view, a crisis of profitability and labor discipline. They wanted to turn all that around, and they mostly did. It was accomplished with an often heavy hand of the state, however, a fact that contradicts neoliberalism's self-identification as being all about getting the state out of the economy. It couldn't have happened had the Federal Reserve under Paul Volcker not raised interest rates towards 20%, producing a savage recession that scared labor into submission and drove the world's debtor countries into the arms of the IMF. It couldn't have happened if the IMF, a body of states, hadn't forcibly supervised the innumerable rounds of austerity, privatization, and market openings that were the solution to the debt crisis. It couldn't have survived without the repeated state bailouts that rescued the financial system whenever it hit a wall. Now the financial system has hit a giant wall, and while the world's states will probably succeed in preventing total disaster, there looks to be something historic about this wall, something end of the line-ish. Even very conventional people on Wall Street are talking about the crisis of an economic paradigm, in the words of ISI's Andy LaPerriere. ISI is the consulting firm run by Wall Street's favorite economist, Ed Hyman. LaPerriere is in his Washington office. To LaPerriere, this moment is very much like 1980, only instead of Reaganism, we're seeing the dawn of a new democratic era. These Democrats, who are basically what David Smick, who was on this show several weeks ago, calls hedge fund Democrats, and they don't have anything matching the transformative agenda that Reagan, a real movement conservative, did. But, and let me conclude on an uncharacteristically optimistic note, since there is no dominant narrative, and since the ruling class has too much egg in its face to talk clearly or to avoid being laughed at when they try, there's a tremendous opening right now. With the public sector now so explicitly involved in an economic rescue, there's room for the public to demand something in return. And while I don't expect all that much from Barack Obama, assuming he wins, and his fellow hedge fund Democrats on their own, the sense of possibility that he's awakened is a very dangerous thing. Back in the Gorbachev days, the anti-communist right loved to quote Tocqueville, saying that the riskiest time for a bad regime is when it starts to reform itself. That's where our bad regime is right now, and it's a good time for us, whoever we are exactly, to go out and make it riskier. Okay, let's take a musical break.
Calling to the postman.
And there was a bit of The Falls, My New House, and the lyric about the Bleeding Bank of England, which I'm not quite sure what Marky Smith was talking about there, but it was, I think that is the only mention of a central bank in a popular song that I can think of. So it seemed apt in these days when central banks were all over the news. We're now joined by Dr. Bryant Welch, who is a psychotherapist in private practice. In South Carolina, and also the author of a book recently published by St. Martin's Press, Thomas Dunn Books imprint, State of Confusion, Political Manipulation, and the Assault on the American Mind. Welcome to Behind the News, Bryant Welch.
Thank you, Doug. Nice to be here.
So, you say that the American mind, or our collective mind, if such a thing exists, has been gaslighted. What does that mean?
Well, the term gaslighted, Doug, is a mental health term that comes from the old movie Gaslight, which was an old movie with Ingrid Bergman, and which a husband was trying to drive a wife crazy so that he could take over her inheritance. And one of the ways he did it was to manipulate her environment. For example, he would turn the gas lights up and down, and when she asked what had happened, he would deny there'd been any change. And the book really just, the movie illustrates what happens to the human mind when the reality that is presented to it is inconsistent with its own assessment of reality. And I point out that that's what's happened in America in a number of ways. I am a clinical psychologist and attorney, and I've spent half my career doing psychoanalysis and the other half in Washington, D.C., working for the American Psychological Association, and I felt in writing State of Confusion that I had a rather unique view of how psychological manipulation plays a role in the political world. And of course, the last 8 years, I think a number of Americans have felt that there was a very puzzling and perplexing way in which there was a almost some called it a dumbing down of America as we made one irrational decision after another.
Well, now, who is doing the gaslighting and how exactly?
Well, I think the most successful, I think that there are guilty parties in both political parties, but I think for the last 8 years, there's no question that the neoconservative movement has been particularly effective in it. And so in the book, I look at how the neoconservatives have used psychological manipulative techniques and how those impact on the human mind, and why the mind regresses or functions much less effectively when they're subjected to those techniques. I also look at Fox News, and for the first time, we've got a heavily propagandistic media that is, I argue in the book, more propagandistic than reality-based. And I look at the growth of fundamentalist or evangelical religion. And those are the three factors that I look at in terms of how they impact the human mind at its deepest levels. And I try to give the reader in State of Confusion a sense of just what it is about those things that I think has puzzled many people in the more progressive community. Why is it so many Americans have succumbed to that?
Well, I want to return to Fox News in a little bit because I have a healthy addiction to watching it, or did until recently. before we get to that, I imagine you're talking about people like Karl Rove and their manipulations, right?
I talk about Karl Rove in particular, yes. But one of the points I make in State of Confusion, unfortunately, it's not limited to him. He's probably the genius of our era. But you see this in a number of areas of life today in America, and it works a lot of destruction and causes a lot of psychological suffering.
All right, give us some examples.
Well, I use some examples from some of the organizations that I was familiar with in Washington of how, for example, a very manipulative, clever CEO could take control of an organization, use it for its own purposes, and cause an institutional regression in which people became less able to function effectively, less task-oriented, and there was a regression in which you literally see staff members functioning in a much less mature fashion. I also looked at some of the regulatory committee boards and committees that I had experience with, and where I had a chance to get an inside glimpse of them. So you can see it in a number of settings, and I tried to take some examples from my clinical work with patients to illustrate these psychological concepts in much more detail, so you can see how it operates up close under the microscope of psychotherapy. But you could also then see why things were playing out as they were, either at the national political level, in trade associations, or any type of organizational structure.
Let's talk a bit about paranoia, which is a favorite topic. Of course, Richard Hofstadter has a famous book on the paranoid style in American politics. This is a tradition with a long history in the American collective mind. But tell us about the mechanisms involved in paranoia and how it really could explain a lot of what we've seen in recent years.
The paranoia is a fascinating process. And as you know, in State of Confusion, I have three of them. I talk about paranoia, I talk about envy, which most people are not familiar with, and I talk about sexual anxiety. Those are the three primitive areas of the mind that I argue have been manipulated by politicians, the media, and the clergy. Now, with paranoia in particular, paranoia is a little different from what we normally think of it in the street sense of the term. It's much more complicated than just sort of an irrational fear or suspicion. Paranoia at its core means that our basic sense of boundaries, our personal integrity, and by that I mean our bodily integrity. I don't mean our honesty. I mean our sense of safety and security is threatened. And the example that I think has demonstrated that is our reaction to 9/11. Now, that was clearly a terrible, terrible event in American history. But I think one of the things that's made it even more painful for people is that it was an assault on our national boundaries. And I talk about what that does to an individual, and it is a paranoid mechanism. I don't mean that someone who responds is a paranoid schizophrenic. We all have paranoid mechanisms. They're what lets us make contact with the outside world, and we do that with varying degrees of sensitivity. If we're too sensitive, then we have a very hard time. We're very frightened as something gets too close to us. If we're not sensitive enough, we're seen as insensitive and impervious to other people. But paranoia is the reaction that we had after 9/11. I think there was a strong paranoid element to it that made us vulnerable to the Bush messages and to making some very irrational decisions that I think most people now realize were irrational.
Now, projection, the psychological defense mechanism, is a very important part of paranoia. How did that operate collectively after 9/11?
In 9/11, what happened is we were faced with a new enemy. It was not entirely dissimilar to what the country went through after World War II, when we had defeated Hitler, and all of a sudden we were faced with a red menace. People, when they can't define who the enemy is and can't find the enemy, they get very anxious. Now, what Bush did in response to that was to come up with the so-called Axis of Evil. And the Axis of Evil, of course, made no sense. It made no sense that Iran and Iraq, that had been at war with each other and had inflicted a million casualties on each other in the decade prior to 9/11, that they were in some type of unholy alliance against the United States or anything else. But the reason the public bought into that, it assuaged the anxiety about not knowing who the enemy was or where you could find him. So we could at least say the nation, that the enemy was confined into this axis, and we could pour all of our anxiety and all of our resentment out at that axis. So we didn't have to deal with a more complicated issue that we really had a problem that was much more of a police problem than one that was consisted of going to war with nation states. I think that the paranoid reaction we had made it difficult for us to understand that And as a result, we went after Iraq when we should have been going after Osama bin Laden.
I'm speaking with Dr. Bryant Welch, who is the author of the book State of Confusion, just published by Thomas Dunn Books. Now, the people who do this gaslighting, the manipulation, Bush and his cronies, are they doing this consciously, or are they also in the grip of some kind of psychopathology?
Well, I think there is a, you know, we all have psychodynamics to us. So does Karl Rove have a very complex psychodynamic makeup? Yeah, I think he does. But the main thing that I'm trying to convey in the book is to show that what I think Karl Rove has discovered, with the Clintons, they were successful because they had an ability to capture the middle. They could figure out which way the wind was blowing and position themselves perfectly. And I don't say that with a pejorative. I'm just saying that was their political style. What Karl Rove discovered was that he could make the wind blow. And he could start out and simply paint a reality that he wanted people to have, regardless of what the reality was, especially if he started early enough. So before people really knew who John Kerry was, Karl Rove was telling them. And he was able to tell people that this guy was unfit to lead before people even knew that he was a war hero. And so he was defined, and in that way, Karl Rove just created his own reality. And that's what the gaslighter does. Now, I don't think that Karl Rove is necessarily attempting to have the kind of devastating psychological impact on people that I claim in State of Confusion he is. But I do think he's trying to manipulate, and I think the manipulations are done consciously. I don't think he's deliberately trying to drive us all crazy.
Well, the clock is ticking, so I want to get to a topic that everyone can't resist, sexual anxiety. Again, this is another topic with a long history in American the American mind, but we've seen it be very salient in politics in the last couple of decades, and you know, gay marriage is one of the things that, at least until recently, had motivated a lot of the religious right. What precisely is it that makes that such a powerful thing for so many people?
Well, what I discuss this at length in State of Confusion, and what I point out is that our sexuality, for many reasons that I talk about in the book that we probably don't have time to go into here, but sexuality is critical to our self-identity, to our self-esteem, to our ability to orient ourselves in the world in a very, very basic, in basic ways. And as you point out, if you look at the presidential campaign since 1988, in just about every one of them, there has been an overarching sexual issue. The Willie Horton ads in 1988 were heavily laden with sexual imagery. And, of course, we had the Clinton-Monica Lewinsky issue with the Clinton administration that affected Gore. And then last time, in 2004, we had the gay marriage issue. And for reasons I talk about in State of Confusion, homosexuality scares many heterosexuals. Seeing someone express sexuality in a way that's inconsistent with how we express it ourselves, it creates an element of disgust and it creates anxiety. So if you get people focusing on that issue at an election time, the party that seems to be offering some protection from it, and 2004 it was the Republicans, is going to have a tremendous advantage. Now, in 2008, the sexual issue has taken a whole new dimension with Sarah Palin. And I think that Sarah Palin, in the past, sex has repelled politically, and I think in this case, McCain's effort was to have sex that would sell. And she certainly has energized, and one even might say excited, the Republican base. And I think if you ensconce her in the kind of religious purity that people seem to project onto her, you've got a remarkable product in which you have a woman with a lot of sexual allure on the one hand and religious purity on the other. So if you can sell sex and purity at the same time, you've got quite a product. And I think that's a big reason for Sarah Palin's appeal.
Now, it's interesting that a National Review columnist suggested that that McCain was thinking when his gonads when he picked her, and this has damaged the party as a result, and this caused great controversy among the on the right. But it would be very ironic if the party were undone by lust.
Well, it would be very it'll be very interesting to try to find out the details of that selection. John McCain apparently spent less time vetting his vice president than most women in the country would take to vet someone to babysit for their children. And yet he was putting this woman in charge of the entire country. I mean, this is a very sick man. He's got a very bad health history. And, we really could be looking at Sarah Palin being president in 6 months. So it's a remarkable decision he made.
We only have about a couple of minutes left, but I do want to ask you, if some of this stuff seems to be some of these classic Republican themes, all these, red meat, sexual anxiety, paranoia issues, seem to be losing some of their power. Are we growing up as a country? Are we getting healthier? Are we distracted by bigger problems? Or what's your diagnosis, Doc?
I'll tell you, Samuel Johnson said nothing focuses a man's mind as the knowledge that he is to hang at dawn. And I think the economy has taken such a grip on people's mental state and on the functioning of our collective national mind that it's been very hard for McCain to jar people's attention loose from that and to get them to go chase a Bill Ayers story or the socialism issue. And I think I think the jury is out on the question you're asking. I would like to believe that's the case, but I think that Obama and probably the country in some ways are very fortunate this economic crisis came along when it did, because I think it preempted a lot of the kind of gaslighting and political manipulation that I talk about in State of Confusion.
Well, if he does win and become president, I think we'll have a lot of material about sexual and racial anxiety to talk about 6 months from now.
Yeah, that's for sure.
We'll stay in touch. Thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Bryant Welch, who is the author, who's a practicing psychologist, a psychoanalyst, and author of the book State of Confusion, Political Manipulation and the Assault on the American Mind, published by Thomas Dunn Books. Let's take a break, and we'll be back to talk about the financial crisis and global warming and stuff like that.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
I took a pounding from the radio today. I heard the radio say...
Thank you, Iggy. This is WBAI in New York, 99.5 in your FM dial, and also on the web at WBAI.org. And as Michael G. Haskins said a half an hour ago, please do take the opportunity to visit our website and make a financial contribution to keep WBAI alive. Very easy to do. Visit WBAI.org and follow the contribute link and do the right thing and help keep free speech radio alive in New York City. All right, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to speak with Glenn Horowitz.
Everything.
Smart Girl Pop. I just love it. That's another song from the Long Blondes' new album. That's called Century. And that is not only their new album, but sadly their last album because their guitar player had a stroke, as I said last week. But this one's a gem, as is the rest of their stuff. We're now joined on the line by Glenn Horowitz, who is the media director for Greenpeace USA and a journalist himself, author of the book Fear and Courage in the Democratic Party, and a contributor to many newspapers and magazines, and he's been on TV a lot, and an experienced spokesperson for Greenpeace USA. Welcome to Behind the News, Glenn Horowitz.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
So we're hearing a lot now, people in Congress and pundits and stuff saying, well, the financial crisis and the possible severe recession we're facing means we just don't have the luxury to think about climate change and other environmental challenges right now. We just have to put that off till better times come. What do you say to that?
Well, they'd certainly like us to believe that because they have a strong financial incentive in us not doing anything about global warming and the various energy problems we have. But the reality is that we can't afford not to fight global warming. We, according to the Natural Resources Defense Council, we are global warming is causing a $271 billion a year drag on the economy, and by 2100 will cause a $3.8 trillion drag on the economy.
Well, so how does that happen? What is climate change? What's the economic impact of climate change?
Well, it's through things like extreme weather, sea level rise, flooding, drought, spread of disease, and damage to crops. All of those things cost jobs. You can see after a hurricane the devastation that comes, and you see what happened to in New Orleans, that it really emptied the city, and we can expect more of those kinds of impacts. Healthcare costs go up as disease spread, and there's a lot of water contamination problems, and so those all cause economic impacts as well. And that's one of the it's a real economic threat. The other thing is, right now we need a lot of public investment to get the economy going again. And you can do that in two ways. You can send it to Wall Street. You can send it to the big auto companies. Or you can send it to clean energy and conservation. And there's a great study done at the University of Massachusetts that showed that investing in the green economy creates more than three times the number of jobs that investing in the oil industry does, two times as many as the coal industry or Wall Street. And I think that's the solution. And I think people actually get it that investing in an economic future as opposed to these outdated polluting energy technologies will produce a bigger economic boom. But certainly we still got to fight the polluter lobbyists who've got a lot of influence and know how to game the political system.
Yeah, how do you go about that? I mean, the oil industry is very politically active, has lots of money to spend. I went to a conference, 10, 15 years ago, that was co-sponsored by Greenpeace and the insurance industry that was trying to get the insurance industry to counter some of the oil industry's spending on lobbying. And it didn't really seem to work then, and it didn't really seem to work now. So how do you fight that kind of concentrated self-interest?
Well, I think we've got one thing on our side in the sense that the oil industry's arguments all rest on a basic argument that they're making, which is, trust me, I'm an oil company. And hopefully the American people can see through that. Oil companies are not very popular and by and large, not very credible. Having said that, they really do understand how to manipulate politicians, and especially Democratic politicians. Because Republicans, they very often don't have to even manipulate because...
they own the Republican Party. That's not a surprise. But how do they manipulate Democrats?
They are really able to make the case that if Democrats, they put so much pressure on them with ads and with messaging like drill, baby, drill, that even though most Democrats know that it's not a long-term political interest to send more money to the oil companies and to allow them to keep polluting, it becomes worth it to them in their perceived short-term interest to kind of jettison any sort of long-term thinking and just give in to whatever the oil companies demand. So this summer, for example, dozens of members of Congress abandoned their longstanding opposition to offshore drilling, not because they thought it would do anything about gas prices, but because they wanted to avoid taking a stand on what had suddenly become a controversial issue. And it's a phenomenon that has really affected the Democratic Party, where they don't understand that people don't vote on issues as much as they vote on whether or not they consider somebody to be a strong leader and has integrity. And if you're always following where the polls go or, just caving to whoever's bringing the most pressure financially or through lobbying, you're not going to win high marks on strong leadership and integrity, which is what people really do care about when they choose a leader. And you're not going to gain that much on these issue positions, which don't really inform the vote that much.
Well, isn't there a real short-term, long-term contradiction or problem here? Because when in the summer when gas prices were high, they've come down considerably from their highs, but they're still pretty high. All people could think about was, I have to fill my tank to get through the day, and it's costing me a lot of money, and I want to do anything to relieve the burden of that expenditure. And yeah, maybe the environment is a problem, but that's a problem that's years or decades away, whereas I need to fill my tank now. How do you respond to that kind of thinking?
Well, you know, I think certainly high gas prices are part of our total dependence on this commodity, which is so volatile, so subject to disruptions, whether it's wars or dictatorial regimes or, you know, price gouging. And so we have to free ourselves from oil, not only to stop global warming, but also to provide a boost to the economy. One of the big reasons that the economy declined so much was because people were sending so much money overseas into the big oil companies to pay their gas bills and to pay, you know, the energy costs that are included in every product that we use. And so one of the things that we'd like to see is investments in efficiency, technology, so we can deploy these exciting new technologies that can really save people lots of money on their gas bills and their electricity bills. Plug-in hybrid vehicles, which are, you know, currently available, running on clean energy, wind and solar power, cost about $1 a gallon to drive. And that is something that, you know, could really change the economics around transportation and, you know, free up money to invest in, you know, making people's homes more efficient or, you know, even if people want to just go on vacation and spend more time with their family.
Well, sorts of plug-in hybrids, I mean, with making the transition to that is going to require an enormous investment, isn't it?
Well, to some extent, the investment has already occurred. Tragically for the United States, much of it has occurred overseas, in Japan in particular. And the Japanese car companies seem fairly far ahead of the American car companies, who spent so much time just spending all their engineering and knowledge on building a bigger SUV, while the Japanese were also thinking about how to make cars more efficient. And so they're in a better market position. That's why General Motors and Ford have been struggling so much. And so, you know, I think you will definitely see in the next few years cars come online that are much more efficient than have been in the past. I think the danger is that we, you know, spend so much money subsidizing the oil companies or the coal companies and, you know, pursuing false solutions like liquid coal technology, which produces twice the greenhouse gas emissions of regular old oil, that, you know, we delay the transition to these technologies. I mean, freedom from oil and coal is coming. It's just a question of how long it will be and how much damage it causes in the interim.
Yeah, I asked this question of several guests in recent months because I'm kind of obsessed with it. But is there such a thing as clean coal?
No. Unfortunately, there's not. I mean, you start with how coal is extracted from the earth in the first place. I just got back from southern Virginia, where throughout the Appalachians, they're just blowing up mountains and taking the coal, and they're flattening all these beautiful places. There's 470 mountains that have been completely wiped off the map by the coal industry. And we were there and taking a tour of these areas, and we heard a big horn, and then you heard a giant explosion, and then you see this enormous cloud of dirt waft all the way over a valley. And you can just see that is, you know, what they talk about when they say clean coal. It is very much not clean at all. And this is happening in some of the most biodiverse forests in the world. And it's hurting a lot of the people who live there, too, because they're sending all that dust into their water supply. And the Bush administration is trying to make it easier for the coal companies to do that. But then, you know, you go to what they often talk about with clean coal is capturing all the carbon dioxide produced from burning coal. And what they don't talk about is that it's extremely expensive to do. It's impossible to get insurance for it, so they'd have to go to the taxpayers to insure this technology because this might sound strange, but the way that they capture it is by sending in pipes to big underground caverns, and there's a risk of that, all that carbon dioxide could be released and asphyxiate people, and no insurance company wants to take on that risk. But what's more is it requires so much energy to capture this carbon dioxide that it actually increases all the other pollutants that make coal bad and cause coal to kill over 24,000 people every year in the United States. Mercury, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide, smog, soot. And so, you know, no matter how you boil it down, it's just not possible to make that dirty black thing that, you know, powers, that provides power for our computers and our lights to be clean. It's a lot easier to just use the things that are clean already, solar and wind power, and it doesn't require these enormous investments. The great thing is the cost of solar power is rapidly declining. Same goes for wind. And we just have to make sure it happens fast enough that the climate doesn't go irreversibly into a catastrophic state.
If that hasn't started already. I'm speaking with Glenn Horowitz, the media director of Greenpeace USA. And of course, if we do burn that coal, even if we could solve all the problems you've just been describing, it releases carbon dioxide. So that's not going to do anything for climate change anyway. So there's really no...
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, it's uncertain that they'll be able to make these technologies they talk about work.
The carbon capture and such.
The carbon capture, yeah. I mean, you know, that's what they spent a lot of time talking about it, but They want to say, you know, let us build all these new coal-fired power plants, and then if we figure out carbon capture, you know, sometime in the future, then we promise we'll deploy it. But the reality is that, you know, in all likelihood, they are not going to do that because it's going to be an extra cost. And, you know, they've resisted every single effort to reduce the amount of mercury that coal produces, reduce the amount of smog and soot and acid rain coming from these smokestacks. And so it's hard to imagine that they'd actually accede at any point in the future to a mandate to deploy technology that cleaned up carbon dioxide.
Now, are there cleaner ways to generate the quantity of electricity that we've become used to?
Yeah, well, you know, the first way to do it is really invest in efficiency and conservation. It's the cheapest way to do it because, you know, you're just saving energy. And you can. It's the equivalent of taking hundreds of coal-fired power plants offline. California has really been a leader in this, in addition to investing in wind and solar power, which are also cost-effective in many places, more cost-effective than coal or nuclear and oil. And they've reaped a tremendous economic boom from that. There's a new report from California, from the University of California, and found that people save so much money on their electricity and gas bills because of California's tough environmental regulations and efficiency standards that they've created 1.5 million jobs and boosted wages by $44.6 billion since 1977. And the contrast to that is with the coal industry, they actually, in many cases, boost electricity rates to finance the construction of new coal-fired power plants. So I've been involved in fighting a new coal-fired power plant in Virginia, and the Virginia government, which is pretty coal-friendly government, actually estimated that the electricity costs would go up so much to finance the construction of this coal plant that it would cost over 1,000 jobs. So there's a real contrast in the economies of how coal works and how oil works and how clean energy works.
Well, and in tough economic times, the appeal of saving some money on energy would be pretty seductive, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you think. And, you know, we've got that on our side. We've got, you know, a lot of money going into PR and political lobbying to persuade people otherwise and to make them believe that coal is either clean or cheap. But, you know, it's not the reality. And it's really a political challenge for us to make that case and to overcome all those efforts. But, you know, the good thing is, at least the coal and oil companies are now trying to persuade us they're green rather than arguing that green is a bad thing to be. So, you know, in some sense, we've won that battle. We've got to win the battle of translating that belief that most Americans have into actual political action.
Well, that's interesting because Bush's former strategist, Matthew Dowd, who since turned on him, once said that if you argue with me but use my language, then I've won. So that suggests that the environmental movement has, in some sense, at least won the ideological battle, if not the policy battle. Speaking of policies, is it possible to mount the kind of conservation efforts you're talking about without government policies, or will this happen spontaneously?
Well, you know, I think the challenge is that there's so government policy for so long has subsidized the coal, oil, and nuclear industries. the Cato Institute, which is this libertarian think tank, and Sierra Club have actually teamed up and called for elimination of all subsidies to all energy sources. Just let wind and solar compete on equal footing with coal and nuclear. And, you know, that might work, but the fact is, the way the political card stars align, it's unlikely we're going to be able to immediately eliminate all these tens of billions of dollars in subsidies that go to the oil and coal industries. And so it's going to require some support for wind and solar and geothermal to make those energy sources flourish. And there's other things that are not energy related that also need to happen to meet the climate challenge, especially saving tropical forests. Destruction of tropical forests account for 20% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And so one of the key things that we'd like to see coming out of international climate negotiations is that we set up a mechanism that finances protection of these forests and can stop deforestation overnight. And if that happens, that'll be the equivalent of reducing all of the United States' emissions right away. And that would be a huge boon to the planet and a pretty affordable way to achieve such big gains. So that's, you know, one area of optimism. And we hope that whoever the next president is will go to Poznan, Poland, where they're having this next round of climate negotiations to help make that happen.
Does Greenpeace have a position on things like carbon offsets, that is, buying buying credits that are spent to do things like restore forests or buy efficient light bulbs? Does Greenpeace have a position on that sort of thing?
Well, it really depends a lot on how they're done. What we would like to see, the important thing is to save the tropical forests and to get the clean energy economy going. And there's a lot of mechanisms to do it. Certainly one thing we do not want to see is some of these offset projects that are being done have really low standards, and they're not real. They're not really taking carbon dioxide out of the air. And so they're mainly set up to make money for financial interest, or in some cases just cut costs for coal companies and other polluters. And so it's important that all these offset projects meet, very high standards. I think ideally we'd like it to be this case that people clean up the pollution at home and then also auction off the revenues that come from producing these permits to pollute and use that money to finance forest conservation and other efficiency improvements and other investments that we need.
So are you supporting some sort of cap-and-trade scheme?
Yeah, we do support cap-and-trade, although the distinction I would make is we don't favor just giving away allowances to pollute. We favor auctioning off those allowances so that there's not just a massive windfall profit for the oil and coal companies. Because in a classic cap-and-trade system, they can just take those permits, pay somebody else who can, reduce their pollution much more cheaply to do it, and then have all that money to give back to their stockholders and their CEO. A better way to do it is to force them to pay for the right to pollute, and then use that revenue to either refund it to the American people or, people around the world, in the case of the international treaty, and also make money available for, doing some of these things we need, like saving forests, investing in the clean energy future.
And turning back to the topic I began the show with, the current financial crisis, what about that as an excuse not to to face the environmental challenges, the climate challenges? What about the possibility of looking to this as these sorts of investments as a kind of way of generating a new kind of cleaner boom, but some kind of economic boom over the longer term? Is there anything to that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's a saying on Wall Street that there's always a bull market somewhere. And a friend of mine who runs a hedge fund said that he was thinking that the bull market was now in environment and clean energy and conservation. And so I think that's exciting. There needs to be government investment in this, but if there is government investment, it'll attract an enormous amount of private investment. And you see in really states all across the country that have done clean energy in a big way, that it is already producing jobs. I mean, Texas is actually the biggest wind energy producer in the country, and it's created a whole new economy there, given farmers and landowners a little extra money for leasing their wind turbines, but also employed people in high-paying jobs in installing solar panels, manufacturing wind turbines, and also, you know, research and development into some of the new sources of energy that could even transform things more. Like, you know, they're trying out tide power in the East River, and you know, most of there's a lot of pilot projects out there that, you know, may pay off in a big way in the future that aren't yet, but those are also things that are creating jobs and economic activity.
And what does the Obama campaign propose along these lines?
Well, the Obama campaign has, by and large, endorsed our principles of, you know, rapidly reducing greenhouse gas pollution by 80% by 2050, and also, you know, creating a massive Green New Deal investment in clean energy. You know, at the same time, we have some quibbles with them. They talked a lot about clean coal and say that they're open to nuclear. But when you drill down, I think overall, you know, we have reason to be optimistic about Obama's platform, because it really does say that we're going to make these investments. I was happy to hear him say that, you know, energy and climate is going to be something that he's not going to drop because of the financial crisis, that he, too, sees it as something that's necessary to get us out of this. And so, you know, I think that's encouraging. You know, McCain has at one time was a more of a champion on climate. He's, you know, still says that global warming is a problem, but has been himself and allowing Sarah Palin to say things that suggest that it's become a lower priority for them, or that the oil industry has gotten more of its tentacles into their campaign.
Well, she's afraid of having Ann Coulter and Sean Hannity go after him, too, I suppose. But, of course, you guys need to keep – should Obama win, you guys need to keep up the pressure after January 20th, because it's going to be – he's going to be under a lot of pressure to cut back on these sorts of things as orthodoxy takes hold. Thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Glenn Horowitz, who is the media director at Greenpeace USA and author of the book Fear and Courage in the Democratic Party. And I've got to say, I think courage is often in short supply in that party. Thanks for joining us. All right. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week. And let's go out with this classic from about 10 years ago, DJ Quicksilver's remix of Insomnia by Faithless. Till next week. Bye.
Yeah, yeah. I only smoke weed when I need to, and I need to get some rest. Yo, where's the cess? I confess, I burned a hole in the mattress. Yes, yes, it was me. I plead guilty, and at the count of three, I pull back the duvet, make my way to the refrigerator. One dry potato inside. No lie, not even bread. The light above my head went bang. I can't see, something's all over me. Greasy insomnia, please release me and let me dream about making mad love on the heath, tearing off tights with my teeth. But there's no relief, I'm wide awake in my kitchen. It's black and I'm lonely. Oh, if I could only get some sleep. Creaky noises make my skin creep. I need to get some sleep. I can't get no sleep. I can't get no sleep. I can't get no sleep. Insomnia.